Welcome to Public Health Matters with Dr. Christina M. Madison, the founder and CEO of the Public Health Pharmacist, PLLC, a public health consulting firm. She is passionate about spreading knowledge on public health in order to create healthier and happier communities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pharmacy Times. Pharmacy in Focus podcast series with me, your host, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist, for another incredible guest on the Public Health Matters podcast. So I'm extremely excited to welcome today's guest. And this actually was very serendipitous because one of my previous guests actually recommended this esteemed colleague of ours, and we're going to dive into some issues around substance use and decriminalization and really just talk about how pharmacists can get more involved in harm reduction. So without further ado, I'm going to let Dr. Jeff Bratberg introduce himself, and we'll go ahead and get started with today's conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, it's an honor and a pleasure. I'm a longtime viewer and first-time guest. I'm Jeff Bratberg. I'm a clinical professor of pharmacy practice and clinical research at the University of Rhode Island College of Pharmacy. I'm excited to be here.
Wonderful. Well, I feel like we can just dive right in. It's so funny. Our pre-conversation before I hit record was quite lively. And I think I kind of want to dive back into one of the things we first started talking about, which is pharmacist involvement in the substance use space and sort of how you got involved in that process. Obviously, I'm involved to a small degree because of my work with individuals affected and infected with the HIV positive status, as well as being, very much an advocate and provider for the LGBTQIA plus community. But I'm just curious what your journey was, because you really are at the forefront of pharmacists providing, MAT and substance use interventions.
Yeah, thanks. I'll try to make it short here. Basically, I was trained as an infectious disease and critical care pharmacist, and I worked on infectious disease services, got involved in advocacy there, helped pass some policy related to immunization activity from pharmacists here in Rhode Island as part of our Rhode Island Pharmacists Association. And part of that, when I was president of our state association, I had to find speakers for a conference. And I met Tracy Green through an ID colleague of mine, Jody Rich. They were both co-authors on the study that we published on buprenorphine access in pharmacies in the New England Journal of Medicine in January. And I met Tracy Green and we started talking about naloxone. And basically, because I had known about laws and collaborative practice agreements and had a lot of connections by that point in the state, I said, hey, let's do this. And we passed the first statewide collaborative practice agreement for naloxone in pharmacies and Walgreens pharmacies almost 10 years ago now. That translated to a whole big naloxone movement, studying its use in pharmacies, what patients thought of it, what pharmacists thought about it. Our state established a governor's task force on overdose prevention. So I was one of the first authors of our plan that is in process of continually being edited now. And so, I've basically been involved in research and service, and we got another grant to study buprenorphine. So moving out of the naloxone space, or I shouldn't say out of just, I'm still in that space, moving into harm reduction, and really just realizing how pharmacists need to treat people, or how people need to treat people, and that we have to meet them where they're at, which is the essence of harm reduction, using all our skills of motivational interviewing for this vulnerable population to say, I tell my students, if you can treat people with substance use disorder, if you can treat them well and treat them, you can treat any chronic disease.
Wow, that's so funny. So sort of the godfather of motivational interviewing within pharmacy is Bruce Berger. And I just interviewed him, and we were just talking about how motivational interviewing could really be revolutionary when it comes to vaccine hesitancy and even just vaccine confidence. And I think it's, when I love communications, it's kind of my love language. And when I think about how we communicate, it really is about language. And I think you and I have both been, when we were chatting, we were talking about just how the evolution of harm reduction language, as it relates to people with substance use disorders, talking about it less as addiction medicine, right? Because the word addiction has such a negative connotation, and more around that space of disease state management, because it truly is a disease. It's not this social experiment or decision that people make, and that if we give people clean needles, that we're not going to enable them to, you know, to inject, we're just going to help them to do it safely. And having these, you know, access points really goes back to something that I'm truly passionate about, which is health equity. And when we think about being able to provide care in an equitable way, that's being able to provide it to access to people who wouldn't ordinarily have it. And pharmacies are literally the gateway for everyone to access primary care, right? If it was up to me, and if I could change the world, right, I would want us to be able to offer more of these point of care services that really allows for the expansion of our primary care services, as we know that we have shortages of primary care providers and individuals who want to work in this space. So with that being said, and I know that you talked a little bit about legislation, do you want to talk about how you guys were able to do this, since there was a X waiver requirement that did limit the ability to provide things like buprenorphine to patients in the past?
Yeah, so I took my knowledge of, or our team took our knowledge of collaborative practice acts and what's necessary there. We allow testing. There's our law was silent on whether we could do controlled substances or not. So some states, again, remember, pharmacy laws are only good in one state. So you go to a different state, it's going to be a different thing. So while I'm working hard with lots of national organizations and leaders to try to translate our study into other states, some can do it already because they're providers. They can have a DEA license. They can prescribe controlled substances. They can maybe even get paid for it, maybe from public and sometimes even private payers. In Rhode Island, this was in the era of the data waiver, which just ended in December. But our collaborative practice really has the data waiver physician delegating all the tasks of the management and the choice of the regimen. And then their name went on the prescription. So it was a legal buprenorphine DEA X waiver that was filled there. Now, the pharmacist would do that. And the only way that we were able to do induction, which is the really revolutionary thing, as many of your listeners may know, that medications for opioid use disorder are much more widely available in pharmacies in the UK and Norway and Switzerland and Canada and Australia. It's just a normal thing where people get their methadone there, buprenorphine there, naloxone's over the counter in Canada, et cetera, et cetera. So in our study, basically, we paid our pharmacy partner to have their pharmacist trained as part of the grant, and I did the training. So we had a CPA to allow them to manage it. But then when the COVID pandemic occurred and the DEA and SAMHSA regulations were relieved, we could actually have audio-only initiation of buprenorphine through the CPA, through our data waiver providers, who would call in on each induction, and then the pharmacist could do the management of that patient for our 3-month study. Our New England Journal of Medicine letter only reports on the data from 30 days, but it's incredibly positive, right? Patients who came to the pharmacy, got started there, they wanted to stay there, and they did stay there versus usual care. So, this is an incredibly vulnerable and marginalized population. 3/4 were unhoused or didn't have transportation, were unhoused. We had double the number of people who identified as Black as compared to our Rhode Island census. So we were serving a population that clearly needed to be served. And these people weren't naive to buprenorphine. A lot of them had gotten treatment before, and we gave them a chance to say, today's the day, come into the pharmacy. We had outreach workers help. And they got started that day, which is not something that usual care often does and has lots of limitations. We provided medication first. Again, the legal structure was there, approved by our health department, board of pharmacy, board of medicine. All of that came through. The agreement is actually in the supplement in the New England Journal of Medicine, so you can read what we put together. But other states need to think about How is their CPA set up? How is autonomous prescribing put up? And our big limitation for sustainability is what we were just talking about before, provider status. That's it. We got to get paid to do this care. But as you sort of mentioned earlier too, is we lack not only primary care, but I think you'd agree behavioral health care is even more in short supply. And so pharmacists to be able to give that first prescription for opioid use disorder, to give that first prescription for alcohol use disorder, we're already doing smoking cessation work. Like, we are so well positioned in communities to provide sort of all of that health, and either maybe even provide behavioral health if you're a prescriber of controlled substances. So provide all that care as long as it's reimbursed. And if your law needs to be changed, hey, everybody listening, do it now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I will definitely make sure that we include that information in the show notes so that people can go back and take a look at that New England Journal of Medicine article, which was pretty groundbreaking. And thank you so much for, you know, what you did as far as, you know, bringing that to print. Because here's the thing, we do the work every day, but there's not a lot of people who are publishing that data. And you know, working in public health and working in population health, data is king or queen, depending on the way you look at it. And I feel like there's a lot within the epidemiologic space and the population health space that we can take from the lessons that they've learned and how they've been able to get funding for things. And it's because they document. And when they document, they take that data and they can, you know, use data to tell a story. And when you tell a story, you can make such a big impact. And it's so much easier to ask for funding when you can show results. And I think that that's really what you guys did. And I applaud you for those efforts. And again, I've said it before, every pharmacist is a public health pharmacist. They just don't call themselves that. And so I would hope that they see that this is an outlet and a potential way that we can be paid for our services, paid for what we're worth, and in the process, help people that wouldn't ordinarily get access to care. A question that I did have for you, and I know this might be slightly out of the topic that we had previously said that we were going to discuss, but have you thought about, because you were talking about mental health services, have you thought about implementation of use of community health workers as part of this program in order to help get people in for the induction process, but then how to keep them in the program post-implementation?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to be very clear, like, we all paid for this study, by the way. This is sponsored by NIDA. And so again, to my colleagues who Tracy Green and Jody Rich and our team who, applied for the grant, they gave us a chance to do this. We proved it in a pilot study. We did the randomized control trial, and we'll have 3-month data coming out soon, showing some what we hope to be exciting results. And to Genoa Healthcare, which is a pharmacy chain that is in most states and embedded in behavioral healthcare. They were a phenomenal partner, continue to be a great partner today. And it's unusual to sort of see these studies done with a federal partner and a chain pharmacy. So we kind of hit the jackpot that we had such positive results and were able to publish that. Can you ask the question? I'm sorry, I just wanted to thank folks again.
No problem. So my question was in regards to community health worker utilization. Yes. As part of the program.
Yeah, since we've done the program, and when we started looking at how marginalized the population was, how many social determinants of health, how many cell phones we gave people to stay in contact with the study, how many transportation Uber health rides that we had to, that people utilized to get to the pharmacy to make their visits, we realized, wow, there's much more at stake here. We need social workers. We need community health workers. There's already an emerging body of evidence of the usefulness of CHWs, community health workers in pharmacies, maybe training technicians to do it. I think that's where, there's sort of two pathways to accomplishing this. You can have pharmacists be independent prescribers and manage people and start people on OUD drugs like buprenorphine, very safe and effective mortality reducing drug. Or we kind of really push the collaborative care aspect to say, team-based care is where it's at. I know you work in a team-based care environment. We were talking about that. But let's not only include community health workers, let's include peers. Peer recovery specialists is what we call it here in Rhode Island. Let's, all of those things can be part of a bundled payment or some kind of way where, why should pharmacists enter a system that is skewed payment, skewed payments to different people and say, let's just create a whole new behavioral health team made up of the people we know that improve outcomes, which is retention and care, referral to housing, making sure people eat, making sure people, get the tests that they need to identify other health problems. And really that's primary care, right? Start with behavioral health, primary care can come next, but all part of that team. So I definitely think that's a great idea and something that we're pursuing.
I also wanted to just point out, the reproductive health side as well. So when we look at individuals who are having challenges with substance use, that often they are within that reproductive age range. So talking with them about ways that they can, get into care in order to make sure that they have healthy pregnancies, that those pregnancies can go to term. Also, just looking at it from a legal standpoint, a lot of times they are hesitant to seek care because they think that their existing children may be taken away by CPS. And so I do want to just make sure that individuals that are maybe thinking about working in this space understand that it's not just the medication, that there's so many other layers to this. Not that I'm telling pharmacists that they need to become social workers or counselors, but I do think that having that understanding of why people choose to come in and get care, maybe from a variety of different reasons. And then also that depending on the state that you live in, the criminalization or decriminalization of substance use disorders really can impact those people's ability and desire to want to get help. And so I know we talked about decriminalization and what that may mean. And also just looking at who's more likely to have challenges with substance use. And I think about the sex worker community in particular, because I have individuals that I work with that are part of the adult film industry, it's kind of a hierarchy, there's people who are doing fans only and the cam girls or cam guys. And then, people who are on the streets and are seeking, payment from an encounter, those individuals will often be on a substance or multiple substances, or their pimp is who got them on the substance. And then that's how they end up being trafficked. And so I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about some of the work that you're trying to do with the decriminalization space. And, I've talked a lot about it here in Vegas because, even though in Las Vegas proper, we don't have legal brothels, we do have legal brothels in other places of our state.
Yeah, I'll maybe broaden a couple ways is when I give talks about treating substance use disorder, you can't tell people to forget about the society they're in that believes criminalization is actually helpful when it's not. The drug war has failed. The drug war is discriminatory. And so ending the criminalization of the use and possession of drugs is a helpful harm reduction. In fact, sometimes we're not even using harm reduction. We want to say risk reduction, which we got from the HIV researchers, right? To say, some people say, you have to think about the person in front of you is the person in front of you, right? If you're interested, think about when you talk to somebody, when somebody shows interest in you, you're like, I think that maybe I trust you and I could get care from you. When most healthcare has been detrimental to anyone immediately when they say they've used drugs or they are using drugs or they're in those communities, stigma and discrimination happen just like that. So it's important for pharmacists and really any healthcare provider to say, look, the person in front of you, they have a story, it's worthy, they're a person. Try to think about how you'd want care provided to you and that person deserves equal care, right? It's about the health equity lens, all those things. So all of these highly stigmatized things, drug use and having a criminal record and being a sex worker, all intersect, being HIV positive. What if you're all of those things, which you probably are because we've criminalized these things. And again, understand that I know that people think that that's actually going to help them, but incarceration increases mortality. Having a conviction decreases your chance of good employment or safe housing. We really have to think about the intersectionality of our carceral system. I don't really like to call it a criminal justice system. It's a carceral system that it has massive detriments. And so, you know, for example, on my study in Rhode Island is one of two states that actually decriminalized the possession of buprenorphine, which then people say, wow, here's this drug that is helping me. I can possess this if I know the law that it's been decriminalized. And maybe if I encounter, law enforcement, I'll be able to possess that to treat my withdrawal and treat my disorder. Maybe I'll get referred to care from law enforcement. We still need to partner with them. We still need to be advocates for our patients and realize that the systems, as you said, is very, very complex. And you know, the work that's being done in Oregon and in other places, I think is really exciting. And we really need to follow it for a long time to see, you know, what the outcome is to shift from a criminalized system that we know doesn't work and taking all of that money, an incredible amount of money, and shifting it into a treatment system, a referral system, and a true care system.
You know, we think about decriminalization, that this is not us or you or I looking at, you know, ways to allow people to commit crimes or do things that are, you know, against societal norms. This is really just wanting to make sure that someone who is suffering from a disease, right? So like if you were suffering from diabetes and I said, I want you to go home and think about your choices and why you're diabetic. And then maybe I might give you some medicine. You would be suing that doctor for malpractice. But in the HIV space, in the addiction medicine space or substance use disorder space, that is so common, right? Like we almost re-victimize and re-traumatize these people when they choose to get help because we have not been taught how to deal with our own implicit biases around something that we could never understand the impetus for why these things are going on with them. And, you know, a lot of, you know, substance use and mental health, research has shown that it doesn't take much for someone to become dependent, and that it really is our existing brain chemistry that is what the challenge is. And I think, you know, as we see things like the FDA looking at putting Narcan OTC, which I have a little bit of misgivings about just because of price and that potentially pricing out people from the system that really truly need it. But I do think it's a step in the right direction because it is showing that this is a life-saving, you know, reversal agent that should be, widely available. I just hope that price doesn't become a barrier to care.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's, you know, the cost of things is part of barriers to care. We talk to anyone who does what you do in free clinics. Like, why do we need free clinics? Why, you know, we're the only country that doesn't have healthcare as a human right. You know, the U.S. did not sign that. And so that is just the difference between us and many, many other countries, both, you know, on up and down the socioeconomic ladder in terms of, is this the primary thing we want to do? Provide care. And I am sure you've talked about this, but the 80 to 90% of care is housing and education and healthcare, and in this country, the color of your skin and how you identify, all of those things are facilitators or barriers to your baseline health and also whether you get the care in that 10 or 20%. And so when I talk about buprenorphine or naloxone, I go, this is keeping the person alive so they can try to address all that other stuff. And people I've talked to say that. You mentioned selling syringes. I just want to have one. We did a focus group and I'll never forget that one of the pharmacists said, we said, okay, you know, what's your feelings on selling over-the-counter syringes? And he said, I had a person that I sold syringes to, and he made a motion of like selling the syringes. And he said, I feel like I kept her alive. I'm paraphrasing. So that the next time I saw her, she had a buprenorphine prescription. And I felt like that was success. That is the essence of risk reduction. You know, and that's in Rhode Island, so we decriminalized syringes. We basically eliminated HIV transmission through massive community and pharmacy-based syringe access so that it's just normalized here, but it's not everywhere. And so we still have a lot to do in getting people educated. We've come far in substance use disorder and risk reduction, harm reduction, but we've got a long ways to go. And so we have a lot of work to do, I should say.
Well, I hope that, you know, this conversation and us bringing, you know, these things up and openly on honestly discussing them and talking about people's lived experience and, you know, you telling that story about that pharmacist that, you know, was able to make an impact. I always say when we help one, we're able to help many. And, you know, that's the difference between public health and population health versus, you know, when we think about disease state management for chronic medical conditions, you know, you may be able to help that one person, but when we think about these kinds of things, you may help an entire community because now someone who wouldn't ordinarily be a productive member of society and be able to be gainfully employed or outside of the carceral system is now able to because you've helped them. And then that therefore goes towards their family. And then they're able to have, you know, someone else in their family go on and be a productive member of society, go on to college, you know, it's a cycle. And the more you lift people out of poverty and you give them opportunity and you give them education and you give them access to healthcare and God forbid, basic needs like housing, food, and transportation, they can actually do good things. And so, again, I thank you for the work that you're doing. I will absolutely make sure that all of those links and the references that you stated during our conversation are added to the show notes. And I would encourage people to continue to follow you. So if people want to know where to find you or to ask you more questions about the work that you're doing, what would be the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Well, I'm still on Elon Musk's Twitter at Jeff with one F Bratberg, JeffBratberg. And then we have our own podcast called The Regimen, and we advertise that on my students' social media feeds. It's at PharmD, PharmD, Pub Health, and that's just PubHealth. So at PharmD Pub Health or at Jeff Bratberg, and find us on, only PharmD Pub Health is on the Insta. I'm too old for Instagram, so I don't do that, but my students do for me. So that's where you find me.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again. I so appreciate this, and I'm grateful to Dr. Kathy Pham for introducing us. If you haven't had a chance to check out my episode with Dr. Pham, please make sure that you check out that previous episode that aired earlier this year. And again, my name is Dr. Christina Madison. I am your host for the Public Health Matters podcast, which is part of the Pharmacy Times Pharmacy in Focus podcast series. And remember, public health matters.